Amen. All right, I invite you to turn with me to the book of Haggai. If you have no idea where that is, go to Matthew and then back up about three small books. You'll be in the right spot. Okay, we've been, if you have a Scofield Bible, it's page 962. If you don't, I can't help you any more than that, other than there's probably an index in the front. We have been going through a study in the Minor Prophets, but we've been doing this chronologically as best we can tell. That is, going through the books in the order that the prophets ministered, not necessarily in the order that they're arranged in our layout in our Bible. So we finished Habakkuk last week, and so now we're going to pick up at Haggai. Now, we're going to do just a little bit of a review. Charlie, if you don't mind turning on that monitor on the back, that will help me not have to turn around here. We are on up here. All right, we're going to do a little bit of a review on the timeline. All right, Israel in captivity. That is, you know, we've talked about it as we've gone along. There were several prophets prior to captivity, and we've gotten up to the point now where Israel is in captivity, and Habakkuk prophesied just before Babylon invaded in the south. But this is a quick review. The Assyrian Empire captured Samaria, which was the capital. If you would hit the button there on the lights for the PowerPoint. That's, I think, number 5. Sorry for conducting business from the pulpit, but I see some of your... All right, so Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. That was captured in 722 BC. Assyria's policy was to remove the leading citizens and the craftsmen and basically relocate people. It helped to diminish the possibilities of rebellion. So they would repopulate the conquered areas with conquered peoples from other places. So they would basically do swaps with the conquered peoples. All right? Assyria then was conquered themselves by the Babylonian Empire. We talked about some of this with some of the prophets that we've talked about. The Assyrian Empire, the capital city was what? Anybody remember? Nineveh. Okay? Nineveh was the capital city. And then Nineveh was eventually conquered by Babylon, all right? So the Babylonian Empire was approximately 620 to 539, the timeline, the Babylon built up, but the actual conquering of Assyria didn't happen until closer to 612, 610, right along in there. But Nabopolassar conquered Assyria in 612, and then Nebuchadnezzar became king in 605. All right, Nebuchadnezzar is a king, is the name of a king you're probably familiar with. All right, what other book of the Bible have we heard the name of King Nebuchadnezzar? Right, the book of Daniel. Okay, so Nebuchadnezzar became king in 605, and 605 is also when the Babylonian armies came in and conquered Jerusalem. Okay, now Jerusalem was conquered in three phases. They came in and they conquered. And in 605 BC, Daniel and his friends would have been carried away. And then after they went back to Babylon, that's when we have the story of Daniel and his friends requested that they not have to eat the king's meat and drink the king's wine and all that kind of thing. Well, they came back again in 597 and took some more away because of rebellions. Well, eventually in 586 BC, they'd had enough, and they came in and absolutely leveled Jerusalem, knocked the walls down flat, knocked the temple down flat. Everything was done, okay, 586 BC. All right, so but 605 here, just prior to Nebuchadnezzar coming in, that is when Habakkuk gave his prophecy. So Habakkuk was the last prophet before Judah and Jerusalem were captured and carried away, all right? He was followed by Evil-Merodach. That just seems like a great name for a king, doesn't it? Evil-Merodach. And then Nabonidus. Okay, but that brings us down to the time towards the end of Daniel's time. Now, during this period, Jerusalem and all the Jews there had been carried away to Babylon. If you remember, Daniel was there. Who else was a prophet who wrote about being by the river there in Babylon? Anybody remember that? Ezekiel. Yeah. And there's actually one of the Psalms talks about there by the river in Babylon, you know, they required of us a song. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? So there was a good period of time where Israel was captive in Babylon. Okay, so between Habakkuk and Haggai, this is what's going on. All right, we're talking about the time period now in between. So we had several prophets. We're going to do a review of the prophets here in just a minute. But we've had several prophets leading up to this point. But Habakkuk gives a final warning. And if you remember in Habakkuk, also God said, look, I'm going to destroy Babylon too. But then from about 605 until, you know, for 75, 80 years, whatever it is, there's no recorded prophet in this way. Daniel and then Ezekiel ministered during that time. But in the minor prophets, there's a gap. All right. So once Nabonidus was then overtaken by the Medes and the Persians, well, then the policies changed and some of the Israelites were allowed to go back. Okay. Because they had left the Babylonians had left Israel there and just said, if you behave yourselves, we'll leave you at home. They didn't behave themselves. They rebelled. They tried to run away to Egypt. So eventually they're like, all right, fine. And they carried them away captive. And that would have been etched in the minds of Babylon. All right, these people are trouble. We're keeping them close, but we can keep an eye on them. Okay. Well, when they were replaced by another world empire, then it was a different policy. And then they began to be allowed to go back. Okay. Does that make sense? Whether it does or not, you're not going to comment. All right. So it was very early on. Cyrus made a decree that the Jews could return to their own land. Okay? This, if you remember, when a pastor did a study last year through the book of Nehemiah, okay, this would have been referenced. But this was well prior to the time of Nehemiah and Ezra. Okay? This was, in fact, probably 80 years prior to the time of Nehemiah and Ezra. All right? But Cyrus makes a decree that the Jews could return to their own land. And some of them did, okay? We'll talk about this a little bit more in the introduction to Haggai, but there was a gap, and then Cyrus confirmed that decree again, okay? So when the Jews that were in Babylon were allowed to return, they didn't all go at one time, okay? I mean, we think of it as point one, point two, point three, captive, return, rebuild the temple, Jesus shows up, you know, kind of sometimes think of it in bullet points. But between the time Darius made the decree allowing them to return and the time that Nehemiah went back and built there. But this first return was led by a fellow by the name of, depending on which book you look at, Sheshbazzar, or I'm trying to remember now, Zerubbabel, okay? One is a Persian name, one's more of a Jewish name, but it's the same leader, all right? So Darius confirms the decree, and then Xerxes, you see that name in history, he's called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. That was also the Medo-Persian Empire. You have Artaxerxes, and it was during his time that Ezra went back. All right, Ezra went back with the priests and tried to reestablish the worship of God. But you see here at 450, we're almost 80 years, you know, 75, 80 years after Cyrus's first decree. And then Nehemiah was another 12, 14 years after Ezra. Now, they overlapped and worked together. But this is the general timeline, all right? So as far as the history of Israel, when Habakkuk finished, you know, right after that, Israel goes into captivity. And then you got 70 years. In fact, Jeremiah had prophesied they'd be in Babylon for 70 years. Okay? Well, if you go from 605 until the time Darius makes a decree they can go back, that's right at 70 years. Okay? Well, then, in fact, Daniel, in the book of Daniel, he said, I understood by books, through the writings of Jeremiah, the time. And then Daniel began to pray. He said, God, it looks like you said 70 years, and 70 years about up. Would you let us go back? Okay. Daniel had influence in that first return. But that's the general timeline, okay, of Israel in captivity. All right. After the Medo-Persian Empire was the Greek Empire that was led by Alexander the Great. And then after that, you have, you know, the Roman Empire in the time of Christ. Okay. That's your big picture, 7.5-minute review of millennia of world history. All right. Now, the prophets, this is the basic order that we've looked at them. Obadiah was very early on, and then Joel, Jonah, Amos, Hosea, and Micah. We've looked at these different books already in our study. Of course, Isaiah was a similar time frame to Hosea and Micah. These were all prior to the Assyrian captivity. These all ministered prior to the first captivity of the northern tribes. All right? Then you had Zephaniah, Jeremiah, and really Habakkuk is right in there as well. Habakkuk was right at the time of the Babylonian captivity. The Babylonian captivity was in three phases, which we've talked about. You have Jeremiah and Habakkuk right in that same timeline, Daniel and Ezekiel. Okay? That on the timeline brings us up to where we are now, which is Haggai. These final prophets from the minor prophets that we're looking at are the ones who prophesied after the captivity, post-captivity. All right? So if you remember from our overview, God sent more messengers before or after. Before. That's God in His mercy warning, hey, you need to repent, you need to repent, you need to listen, you need to pay attention. But God didn't say, all right, fine, I'm done with you. God sent them prophets during captivity and after captivity too, right? But the ones that we're looking at now would be post-captivity, after the Assyrian captivity, after Babylon. This is now in the time of the Medo-Persian Empire when Israel was allowed to go back to their own land. You have Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Okay? So there won't be a quiz on that next week, but just for those of you that like to try to keep it in perspective, where are we on the timeline of the history of Israel? This is where we are. All right? So Haggai, the time of his ministry is approximately 520 BC. Okay? Now, let's talk about the man Haggai. All right, where do we see his background? Well, quite honestly, we don't see much. Look with me at Haggai 1:1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet. Well, that's pretty much it. Look at Haggai 2, verse 1. In the seventh month, the 1 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, chapter 2, verse 10, the 4 20th day of the ninth month, the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord to Haggai the prophet, saying, all right, chapter 2, verse number 20. Again, the word of the Lord came unto Haggai in the 4 20th day of the month, saying, okay, that's all we know from the book of Haggai. He was a prophet. There's a couple of references from Ezra 5 and Ezra 6. Ezra 5:1 says, the prophets, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Ezra 6 and verse 14, the elders of the Jews builded and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. That's it. So, who was his father and grandfather? We don't know. What was his family lineage? We're not told. You know, what was his adjusted gross income? We're not told. Now, we don't know much about the man other than God sent him. Okay, what we do know is God sent him, and this was the word of the Lord. It's interesting. If you look back in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai. Chapter 1, verse 3, then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet. Okay, we do know that he was God's messenger. I mean, it didn't exactly happen this way, but if I took this order of services up here, wrote a note on the back of this, put it up and said, you know, Brother Jim, pastor's not in here this morning. Would you take this message and go find him and give him this message for me? Okay? Would it be Jim's message or would it be my message? It'd be my message and Jim would deliver it. That's what Haggai is doing here. Okay? God gives him a message. He's delivering it directly. Okay? So, all we know about the man is what we see here in Haggai and Ezra. The time of the book is the second year of Darius. There's more than one king with the name Darius. I'm not going to even bother trying to pronounce the other name there. But it's 520 BC. Okay? And according to the time that he gives of the sixth month, the ninth month, etc., the book of Haggai, there's three or four short messages all in a period of about 4 months. Okay? So Haggai is just a very small snapshot in the history of Israel. His name means festive. It's from the word that means feast. So could be worse. Could have been named Eeyore, right? So, all right, now, the timeline between Habakkuk and Haggai. We've talked about this a little bit already, but here's the general overview. In 586, you had the temple destroyed by Babylon, all right? And then you have a period of about 50 years of nothing, all right? Well, then in 539, Babylon is conquered by Cyrus the Great. In 538 or so, you have the decree of different commentators. Some say 538, some say 536. You know, that long ago, and the way the records were kept, it's hard to get it, you know, more precise. But somewhere around that 538, 536 time frame, you have the decree of Cyrus permitting the Jews to return. All right? This first return was led by Sheshbazzar, who here in chapter 1, verse 1, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel. Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are the same person. Okay, one is a Persian name, one is a Jewish name. Just like, remember Daniel and his friends? The king gave them Babylonian names. Okay, it was Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and what were their new names? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What was Daniel's new name? Anybody remember that one? So, you have the Persian names. Well, Sheshbazzar was, I think, the Persian name, and Zerubbabel the Jewish or Hebrew name. But he led the first return. These are the first ones that were allowed to go back, right? In around 535 BC, the foundation of the second temple was laid in Jerusalem. There is mention of this in Ezra and Nehemiah about those that saw this. Some rejoiced and some wept, right? Because there were, at this point in time, at 535 BC, there were some folks still living who had seen the previous temple. Now, in 580, the temple that was knocked down, that temple had been built by whom? Solomon. Okay, that's the one that the floors and the walls were overlaid by gold. It had the magnificent porch. It had all of the, I call them prophets' chambers, but all the priests' chambers around there, and the treasuries, and the magnificent altar, and all those things. Now, through the years, when invaders had come, different kings had robbed the tribute money. We're told several of them took the gold out of there. Some of them cut the gold off the doors of the temple. You know, they did all kinds of things. So it gradually diminished, but it was still a magnificent house. Well, in 586, Babylon knocked the whole thing to the ground. Okay? Carried away the gold and silver vessels. If you remember the night of the drunken feast in Babylon, when his handwriting on the wall, you remember that story from Daniel? At that drunken feast, they were using the gold and silver cups from the temple in Jerusalem. And that's when God sends in the handwriting on the wall and says, you're done. You're finished. Okay? But at that point in time, Babylon had carried it away and that one's gone. So about 50 years later, they at least laid the foundation for the second temple. So 50 years later, there were still some folks living who had seen the previous temple and its magnificence. Now they see the foundation laid for the second temple, and the younger people are rejoicing because, hey, we got the temple back. And the older people weren't displeased with that, but they were saddened because they realized that this was not going to be nearly as magnificent in some ways as the Temple of Solomon. However, I'm going to get ahead of myself a little bit. This is covered in Haggai chapter 2. This temple would be more glorious than Solomon's temple. Anybody want to guess why? Or maybe you know why? Say it louder, Doc. Well, yeah, God himself would walk there. is the temple that was rebuilt, that eventually Jesus himself would walk in this temple that's being rebuilt during the time of Haggai. Okay? So in that sense, yes, there was a glorious appearance of Solomon's temple, cloud filled the temple at the dedication and all of those things. But in a very real sense, this second temple that's being built would be more glorious because the Son of God himself would walk in that one day. Okay? But, so that's the timeline. In Sheshbazzar and his group returned, Zerubbabel, and they got started. Okay? Ezra 3, that's the reference with the comparison to the first temple and the older men sorrowing. In Ezra chapter 4, we hear about the opposition from Israel's enemies. You remember that? They tried to make a treaty with them, and then they tried to accuse them. So we read about that. And then in 522, you had the decree of Artaxerxes. That's the name used in Ezra, was the name Artaxerxes. Okay? That said, stop building. All right? Haggai is after this. Now, some of you are familiar with it. Some of you aren't, but look with me real quickly in verse 3, just to set the tone. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, "Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste?" Okay? So what was going on was the people that had gone back had started the temple, and then it had laid dormant. Sometimes in our minds we think, okay, they started, and boom, immediately Geshem and buddies from Ezra and Nehemiah, the opposition showed up. There was actually a gap. Okay? Now, this was, well, the ones that actually opposed Nehemiah, that was a good bit later. But there was opposition recorded in the book of Ezra about these guys. Okay? But what was the gap? If 535 is when the temple foundation was put in, and then the decree was 522 to stop building, how long is that gap in there? Carry the one. How many years? Yeah, 13. Okay, 13 years. So did the temple building stop entirely because of opposition? No. There was definitely fault on the part of the people of God as well. Maybe the ones that had seen the first one saw the foundation and they were discouraged about it. Maybe that discouragement rubbed off on others. Okay, maybe they just got distracted. You ever had a project going and then other things seem to take priority? If you have a house, you know exactly what that is. You know, if you have a job and a supervisor, you know what that is sometimes. You know what you want to work on and then you're told something else is higher priority. Okay? And, you know, those of us with honeydew lists understand that too. Not that they get done, but, you know, that's what the priority is. But the point is that the people had, it was partly due to opposition and partly due to their own slackness. But there's a gap here. 535 is when the foundation was laid. 522, right around there, is when the decree of Artaxerxes went out saying, stop building the temple. All right? In 521, Darius, depending on how you're going to pronounce it, succeeds Artaxerxes. All right? New administration, change in policies. And so he then reinstituted. So the appeal was made to Darius. He looked at the decree of Cyrus and was like, no, yeah. So Darius then allowed them, or in 520, to resume the building. Okay? So that is the historical timeline that brings us to the time of Haggai. All right, the Jews have been in Babylon. They've served the minimum time that God said they were going to be there. They were allowed to return. But the initial return and the laying of the foundation for the temple was 15 years prior to Haggai. 15 years. 2006. What was going on for you in 2006? Ben, were you even born then? No, I'm just kidding. Okay. He was three. yeah, 2006. Some of you are thinking, yeah, my kids were about, you know, yay big. They were still at home. What's that? Yeah, kids were just born. Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about from 2006 to now. That's the gap from the time the foundation of the temple was laid till the time that Haggai the prophet begins his ministry. Okay? Now, it's going to be another 60 years or so before Ezra comes back, 70 before Nehemiah. So you had the first return led by Zerubbabel or Sheshbazzar, depending on which name is used. And then Ezra and Nehemiah were much closer together, but you know, much later on the historical timeline. All right. So the book of Haggai is divided into five sections, basically four brief messages or so, five sections. Chapter 1 has two sections. Chapter 2 has three sections. All right, pretty simple. So let's look now in chapter 1 and the verse number 1. The second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, saying, that was a lot of names. There's some information there, okay? Some important information. But you have here Zerubbabel, and Ezra is called by his Persian name, Sheshbazzar. It's the same guy, right? That would have been your civil leader, okay? Now, if you try to follow that, he said he's the son of Shealtiel. If you try to follow that genealogy, there are some interesting twists and turns there. But in Jeremiah 22 and verse 30, we're told that Jeconiah would not have a son to succeed him on the throne. If you go to Matthew and Luke and look at the two side-by-side genealogies of Joseph and Mary, you do the comparison, you see that Joseph was actually of the line of Jeconiah. So Joseph did not have the right to the throne. However, Mary was from a different line of the family of David, and her son, in fact, did have a right to the throne of David. Okay? So when you do the comparison, and I'll spare you all the details, but what you see here is that this was a descendant of David, not through Jeconiah, but through the line of David's son, Nathan. Okay? So, and you have the term here, governor. This was a generic title, like ruler. Okay, that could be city council, that could be county commissioner, that could be state house representatives, that could be the state governor. I mean, this was a title that was used for varying levels of leadership or authority. Okay, and then you have Joshua, the high priest. All right, so what you have in this context then, you have Zerubbabel and Joshua. Zerubbabel is the civil authority, the leader of the civil government. Joshua is the high priest. So he is the leader in what realm? There you go. The spiritual or the religious realm. Okay? So Haggai is addressing his message to these two combined. Why? Because what was God's design for the nation of Israel? That there would be a linking, there would be an overlap with the civil government and the religious government, if you will, or religious laws in Israel, okay? So, chapter 1, verse 2, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Now, this is kind of interesting. Is this a personal reference? How does God refer to the people of Israel, you know, in the Old Testament? My people. That's often, okay? Even the name Israel references the special relationship of Israel and God, okay? I just think it's interesting that he says, thus saith the Lord, this people say. Okay? He's talking about you, but right now there isn't that the special relationship that there ought to be. Why? Because they were giving God the proper reverence. And their relationship with God was not in the proper perspective. Okay? This people say, it's almost like, you know, when you get home or you get a message that says, guess what your son did or guess what your daughter did. You know, it's a little bit like that, you know, where it's a kind of there's still a relationship, but there's a little bit of a strain for some reason. Okay? This people say, the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. All right, now one commentator said it this way. Their inaction was not the compulsory and painful restraint of zealous patriots and ardent worshipers. Well, that's a good statement, but you probably need to back up and run by it again. In other words, it wasn't that they were patriots and they were religiously zealous and they were physically being restrained or being restrained at the point of weapons. It was not that. But the easy and selfish indifference of an ungrateful and unfaithful people. You remember, this is the reason I stopped and pointed out there was a gap of 13 years from the time the foundation of the temple was laid until Haggai's preaching. That was not all due to opposition from without. That was not all due to the king's decree saying stop. Okay? This had as much to do with their getting sidetracked, their having other priorities, and this people say the time's not come. Well, it's not really time to work on building God's house now. You see in verses 3 and 4, they had spent time on their own house. Okay? It's interesting. You know, the priorities were different. So the point I'm trying to make is there was opposition, yes. But there was not only opposition from without, and if we're honest, especially for us as American believers, opposition from without is not probably our most difficult hurdle. The world, the flesh, and the devil, okay, the externals probably give us far less trouble than the internals, right? We battle with our own flesh more than anything else. And they had the same thing, but the point I'm making is that they said, oh, it's not time to work on the Lord's house. God is getting ready through the prophet Haggai to vehemently disagree with their, okay? Chapter 1, verse 3, then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet saying, all right? So, in verses 3 and 4, we have an accusation. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses and this house lie waste? Okay, you see that it's the word of the Lord. This is not Haggai's message. I would venture to say that this morning probably don't thrive on personal conflict. I mean, if you do, there are probably other issues that need to be addressed, right? In fact, most of you probably really don't enjoy if you have to deliver bad news or things that you don't think are going to be well received, right? Haggai would probably rather not get up and say, you're a bunch of sluggards and backsliders, if I could summarize and oversimplify his message, right? But God said, you go tell him this. When God says, you go tell him this, what's his responsibility? Deliver God's message, okay? So it's the word of the Lord. Okay, then you have a rhetorical question. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses? What's the understood answer? Nope. This is a rhetorical question. Is it time for you to take care of your house and neglect the house of God? The understood answer is no. Now look with me in verse number 4, the first line there. Is it time for you, O ye? That's kind of a strange construction, isn't it? And most of the time, if we're doing Bible reading, we'd probably just kind of skip right by it. But twice here, you have a repetition. It's the same personal pronoun. You, ye. Now, we do that sometimes in personal conversations. Whether it's, you know, we'll call it a discussion, not an argument, and we're trying to make a point. Or maybe you're trying to make a point with children or grandchildren. No. The issue is you. It's your responsibility, right? We would use a repetition of a phrase like that. Well, that's what God's doing here. You see this repeated little pronoun here. Is it time for you? Oh, you. Even you. Is it time for you? Yeah, you. To work on your own house and neglect God's house. You have an emphasis. You have a personal application here of a very convicting question. Should you be working on your own house to the neglect of God's house? The understood answer is no. Now, let me see if I've got the quote up here. Yeah, I do. All right. The temple was the very condition of the national existence for Israel. Okay? That was the symbol of their existence. If the returned exiles were to be organized and to continue as a distinct people, the temple must be restored and sacredly guarded. Other nations might exist without such a palladium, a central building, they could not. Get that? Other nations could be just fine without having the house of their God. But what was central to the very existence of the nation of Israel? The house of God. In fact, before God ever gave them a land, he gave them a house. It was the tabernacle. And then eventually the permanent temple was built. But because of the way that God had designed the nation of Israel, this was God's people, this was to be a special people to him, the worship of God was central to the very existence of the nation of Israel. So as such, no nation can afford to ignore God. Okay, that's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying, as such, it was even more crucial for Israel to give special attention to the house of God in trying to reestablish their nation. Okay, so all of these, all the prophets to a greater or lesser degree have emphasized the temple. Okay, they've talked about the house of God, sometimes the idolatry or the desecration of the house of God. But Haggai's sole focus, based on the time that he ministered, is the temple. Because that was so central to the life of the nation of Israel. Okay? So, you have an accusation in verses 3 and 4. In verses 5 through 7, you have an assessment. All right, verse 5. Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You've sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Now, did you notice the repetition there? Now, what phrase is repeated twice in three verses? Consider your ways. Okay? So this is absolutely a call for them to pay attention. I use the word assessment because it alliterated with my outline. But if I'm going to do an assessment, okay, where do we use the term assessment or assessor in our society today? Tax assessor, yeah. They evaluate your property and say it's worth this, and then they apply the formulas to it and say, okay, your tax is this amount, okay? But to assess is to evaluate. Have you ever gotten into a project and you're like, okay, I got to stop and assess things and maybe reevaluate? Okay, maybe we need to attack this differently. Sometimes you just stop and assess, all right, is what we're doing, are we doing it the right way? Are we having the desired effect, et cetera, et cetera? Okay, here God is calling them to an assessment. The phrase in verses 5 and 7, consider your ways, literally means... All right, I didn't put it on here. I thought I did. All right, the term consider your ways literally means put it to your heart. How might we say that in our terminology today? Take it to heart, yes. Okay, hey, you need to listen up. You need to take this to heart. What do we mean by that? Do we mean that, you know, we're going to attach it to our chest? Do we mean we're going to take a pill that's, you know, heart medication to help straighten out whatever you want? No, to take it to heart is a metaphorical expression that means what? Examine. Take seriously. Okay? Make an honest assessment, and then implied in this is also, all right, there's probably adjustments or changes that are needed, right? Consider your ways. Now, if God's saying, hey, you need to think about that, is that for his own benefit? Is that for our benefit? Obviously, when God asks questions, it's not for his benefit, it's for ours. So when God's saying, hey, you need to stop and think about that, there is definitely an implication that changes are necessary. Changes are needed at this point. Now, therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Now, if somebody says, hey, you need to think about that, you should probably do that a little differently. How you respond probably in large part depends on who's saying that, right? If your kids are young, you know, you may or may not put as much weight on it. You have grown kids that say, hey, Dad, maybe you should think about this. Okay, well, maybe I'm going to stop and think about it, okay? If you respect the opinion of the person that says, hey, you need to think about this, you're going to give it more weight. If the laziest person at work tries to come and tell you how to do your job, How much weight are you going to give to their assessment? Whatever. Who's speaking here? Who is saying, hey, you need to think about this? Who's the speaker? God is. Okay? If God is speaking, it should have the utmost respect, right? Same for you and me. Lord, I'm listening. What do you want me to hear? Okay? Now, we'll have to stop there for today. But you see here, Haggai is ministering at a very crucial time in the history of Israel. And his message starts with, you're wrong. You say it's not time to build God's house, but it is. God says, consider your ways. So hopefully he has the attention of Israel, and hopefully the Lord has our attention as well. Let's pray. Lord, thank you.